This is Writer's Cast, a podcast interview series with your host, David Wilk. My goal in this program is to explore the writing process, to talk to writers about the characters and stories that they write, and to ask the questions that readers might ask if they had the opportunity. I'm an editor, a publisher, and sometimes a writer myself. Today, it's February 17th, 2009. And I have the great pleasure of interviewing a first-time novelist but experienced writer, Brian Grewley. He's the author of a forthcoming novel called Starvation Lake. It's a mystery, so I'm going to be very careful, and I think Brian will obviously be careful not to give anything away that might spoil the book for readers. So, Brian, welcome to Writer's Cast.
Hey, thanks for having me, David.
Well, thank you. Well, just, you know, so people have a sort of geographical sense, where do you live?
I live in the city of Chicago on the north side. I'm about six blocks from Wrigley Field, the great baseball ballpark.
Are you a Cubs fan by any chance?
No, I'm a Detroit Tigers fan. I'm from Detroit. I live in the Cubs neighborhood, so I'm all for the Cubs winning. I'd love to see the Cubs play the Tigers in a World Series, and then I would root for the Tigers to sweep them.
Did Tigers ever play the Cubs in a World Series, I wonder?
The last series the Cubs were in was 1945. The Tigers beat them.
Ah, that's right. Oh, very good. So who's your favorite Tiger player when you were growing up? This is just a curiosity.
My favorite was Bill Freehan, number 11, the catcher.
Yep.
He played catcher. I played catcher when I was a kid.
Yeah, I played catcher, too. I remember Freehan. He was good.
Yeah, it's fun to play catcher because you're always in the play.
That's what I always... I told my son that didn't make a difference. I could not raise a catcher. So maybe you could talk a little bit about what got you into being a novelist. Maybe you want to talk a little bit about your background as a journalist for the Wall Street Journal and other things you've done.
Well, it's funny. A couple of people have asked me, why did you write a fiction instead of nonfiction? Why did you take this detour? In thinking about it, I thought, well, really, my career has been the detour, because when I was a kid attending St. Gemma's Elementary School in Detroit, I used to make up stories. I read the Hardy Boys books my mother bought me, and I made up my own version of the Hardy Boys, the Andersons. I know one of them was named Chip and the other, I think, was named Scott. And I'd write these stories out longhand, and then I'd read them to the class. And I always wanted to write fiction. But when I got out of Notre Dame in 79, there weren't any companies out there that just pay you to sit and write novels. I ended up going into the newspaper business, and partly because I'd always been a writer, and I thought I'd get to tell stories. And I've been lucky enough throughout my career, from a couple of small weeklies outside of Detroit through to the Wall Street Journal, to not just do hard news stories, which I've done hundreds of as writer and editor, but also to have been lucky enough to write lots of small and longer narrative stories, because I just like the puzzling out of how do you put things in the right order so that people read them from beginning to end. And finally, I put my butt in a chair and my hands on a keyboard, and I had the discipline to stay with something long enough that I could say it was the first thing I admit to having made up.
Well, that's always an interesting process question. I think that, a lot of people are aspiring novelists. I think the world, if you tapped...
Just about everybody I've ever met.
Yeah, well, almost everybody says they've always wanted to write a novel, or they have one in the drawer. But I think the biggest problem that most people have is what you just described. How do you manage, while you've got a job, to actually sit down and write an entire novel?
Well, it's that first rule, ass in chair, it's a great rule. I actually had never heard it, but a friend of mine, Ken Wells, who also worked at the Journal for many years, terrific writer and journalist, Ken wrote his first novel, or published his first novel, Mealy LeBove, a wonderful book. And after Ken did it, I think that inspired me. I thought, you know, here's my friend. I know this guy. It's not some mystical person out there who's a novelist. It was just Ken. And he wrote a great book. And he always used to say, you know, man, you just got to put your ass in the chair and write it. So I thought, Wells can do it. I can do it. And that kind of propelled me into doing it. And then it's just a matter, you know, you got to, whenever you do it, I do it in the morning. I get up early and I write, and usually between, well, at least 4 days, sometimes six, usually 5 days a week, I write. And if I get 500 good words before I have to go to work and pay the bills, that's a good day. And I feel better all day if I get 500 good words.
So when you, I mean, here's another question about process, and I don't want to spend the whole time talking about process, but do you write and then just get it down on paper and edit later, or do you edit while you're writing to try to make that 500 words be the best 500 words you can get together that day?
It's somewhere in between, David. On my first book, one of the mistakes I made was to keep going back and polishing and editing. And that was a big mistake because I was fixing things I didn't even know were going to be in the novel in the end. The main thing for me, and I suspect for other writers, is to figure out what happened. It's almost analogous to the process of reporting a story. You can't really write it, even though you might write pieces of it. You can't write it until you've reported out what happened. Now you can put it in the right order and use the right details to make it a compelling story. And as I'm writing the second book now, a three-book deal, I just force myself to move forward because I want to find out what happened. I'm doing, in effect, the reporting. But I do edit because I've been doing this for 30 years. So I partly edit even as I'm typing, and I'll go back and fix this and fix that. But just in very short, you know, I'm going back a sentence and I move things around as I'm going. But is it the best 500 words I could write? But probably not most mornings. But I'll go through it here. And then there's a second book I'll be going through very shortly. And I'll do a lot of editing. And I've done it so much, I'm pretty ruthless with my own.
But it sounds like you, this is an interesting point. You didn't make up the story completely, almost like a storyboard, and then write it.
No, the actual writing of the story for me is part of the process. I mean, you know, some writers outline. I'll plot out a few points ahead, but generally I figure, you know, the characters will take me in their own directions. And I know lots of authors say, well, the characters, you know, they take over. But really, they don't. They don't exist. But what I think really does happen is, you know, while I'm at work or while I'm playing hockey or while I'm having dinner with my wife and I'm not really thinking about the book, my brain is nevertheless, some part of my brain is working on it. And then when I sit down the next morning and I think, okay, here's what's going to happen today, my brain goes, well, no, sorry, pal, I've been working on this for the last 24 hours.
Here's where
it's going to go. And part of the discipline, this is going to sound antithetical, but part of the discipline is to trust your instincts, because your instincts have been actually working on it for the last 24 hours when you've been paying attention to the, you know, other things.
No, I think that's a good really good explanation. Well, I think that the story in this book, and I think that for a mystery, it's very important, and I think I can say this, you know, I don't consider myself a, you know, a superior critic or anything, but reading the novel, I did not feel at any time that the story was forced or constructed, and to me, that's a very important part of reading a mystery in particular, that you want to feel that the story unfolds, and that, you, of course, you know that there's a mystery because it says it right on the cover that it's a mystery, but you want it to be a surprise. You want it to be a kind of an unfolding, an uncovering of something that was there, and not the creaky, you know, kind of forced story that sometimes happens. I have to compliment you because I think this story is both complex and compelling. And obviously, it takes place in Michigan in a small town. The protagonist is a newspaper writer, and I wanted to ask you a couple of questions about newspapers. Clearly, you know, you can draw on your experience working in small town newspapers, but how literal was some of the the background? You had some tension between the person running the local paper and the corporate owners who were farther away. Is that kind of stuff really, that's what happens?
It happens, yes, is the short answer. I personally haven't experienced a whole lot of that in my career, but I've witnessed it. I have hundreds of friends in the business, so it wasn't hard to imagine. And of course, it was personified in a lawyer, and every lawyer, not every lawyer, but many, many, many of the lawyers I've run across are constantly defending their territory and extremely conservative about what can be done or not. And so it was easy in this embodiment. But a lot of the other detail about the newsroom and what it looks like and what it smells like, and the photographer and the young reporter, a lot of that is just, you know, I drew on my own personal experience working at weeklies, small daily, bigger daily, really big daily, over almost 30 years.
Well, it certainly comes through, I think, for people who are at all interested in richness of detail in a story, having characters that are kind of familiar in some sense, or, you know, not just types, but are really complex characters who kind of enrich the environment. You got a lot of characters in this story. And I think there's a subtext. I don't think it's giving too much away that there's a key element of ethical behavior for the main character that is unique to the newspaper business, that he's faced with a decision that he has to make about a source. That's kind of a recurring undercurrent that goes through the entire story. It's not part of the mystery in that literal sense, so I don't think I'm giving it away, but I thought that made your main character pretty interesting because you put him into a moral, ethical dilemma, and you did not reveal what was going to happen or how it was going to happen in any way until the very end, which, again, you know, it kind of carries forward along with the rest of the story, and I think it added to the flavor of the book.
Thank you.
Now, there's one thing I had to ask you about.
Sure.
As there's a car in the book, a Pontiac Bonneville.
Bonnie.
From the late 60s, 69, I think it was.
Yeah, I think so. Might be a 70. I don't remember exactly.
Big
you
car.
Probably remember the book better than I do. I haven't read it in a long time.
Yeah, no, it's an impressive car, and it plays a pivotal role. I wondered if that car had some particular meaning for you, or if it was just it just needed to be there.
Well, I needed a big old car because it comes from Gus's father, who's dead. Many years, in the present tense of the book. Originally, I had used a black 98 because I had a black 98 that my father gave me when I was in high school, a car I loved. But in the end, I just wanted to distance myself from my own car. I said, it just didn't feel right. And so I latched onto the Bonneville, and there actually was a friend of mine had a car exactly like this car. This kind of baby poop yellow Bonneville with a white cream top, and I wanted it to have an 8-track, and then it had to have a song on the 8-track, and you know all of this was not planned. It was just sort of organic, and then I had to have a song, and the original song I had in the book, and as you know, there's a song that plays a role. was Hard Drive-In Man, which is off a live album by the Jay Giles Band recorded in Detroit in the 60s. A song I just happened to love. And later on, I just thought, it doesn't have anything to do with the story. So I chose an old song, just on a whim, an old song by Bob Seger that probably only the most hardcore of Seger fans would know, called 2 Plus 2 Is On My Mind.
And, of course, that's a Pontiac 2 Plus 2.
I guess it is. I don't know. But this is a long story, but it's going somewhere because I remembered the song. I haven't heard it, or I hadn't heard it in at least 25 years. And I looked up the lyrics on the web. I couldn't find an audio of it, but I looked up the lyrics, and I realized when I read it that it was an anti-Vietnam song. And when I read that, then I decided that Gus's father would have a cousin, and the cousin loses his life in Vietnam, and this changes. I'm in the middle of writing this now, and it's changing for me as I'm discovering what this song was about, and it helped me understand what Gus's father was about, which is important to the ending of the book.
Well, that's good.
So Bob Seger should probably get a...
Well, Bob Seger is very, I mean, that's clearly, he is a Detroit figure.
Yeah, oh yeah. And great, you know. My uncle saw Bob Seger at a teen dance in 1962.
Yeah, no, he's emblematic. This book is, I mean, clearly, for anybody who's spent time in the Midwest, it's got a great kind of wintry Midwestern feel to it. The hockey is fantastic. You know, clear, and I know that you're a hockey player yourself.
Yeah.
It's pretty authentic. You know, even for people who have not played a lot of hockey, I think you got across, you know, the kind of a lot about how hockey fits into small town life in a lot of those places. And I think it's, you know, to me, well, it's a terrific book. I will say, you know, I mysteries are not my first read of choice. I have often read plenty of mysteries, but I don't gravitate to them. But this one really got a hold of me, and I read it pretty straight through.
Thank you.
And, you know, I have to compliment you. I think it's a really well-done piece of writing.
Well, you know, what you say about mysteries, I'm still learning about the publishing world, and I just set out, I've read a number of mysteries, and I've read a few thrillers. I really like Michael Connelly stuff. And I read Chandler and Hammett, but I didn't really set out to write any kind of thriller, mystery, crime, whatever. I just wanted to write a great story. And it was the publishing world that told me this is a mystery, you know, like this is frozen food or this is dairy or this is produce. But to me, you know, most great novels are mysteries. Sophie's Choice was a mystery. The Catcher in the Rye, it starts with a question. Holden Caulfield's in an insane asylum. How the hell did he get there? We don't know. The author's going to tell us. It's, you know, it's different. I agree to a degree, but most novels pose lots of small questions, the answers to which pose some larger question, and at the end you're left with some answer. I think, you know, the great novelists leave you with such a complex answer that many different readers can divine different things from it.
I think that's
their imagination engages with the book.
I think that's a great description of what makes a book really work. And
blow up a car every now and then.
Right.
Make it fun.
Well, you got to
have something happen.
Got to have some excitement and something something to keep people moving.
I didn't blow up a car, but sink a pickup truck in a river.
Right, and yeah, you had some action here, definitely. Well, I really appreciate your spending the time talking about this. I mean, there's so much more. Maybe we can do another conversation because I think there's a lot to be talked about here. The book is called Starvation Lake. It's by Brian Grulli. It's published from by Simon & Schuster. It's coming out in March 2009. And I really hope it does well.
Me too.
Take care, Brian.
Thanks a lot, David.
Bye-bye.